just want to say before I get started that I looked a lot better than this, but then it started raining and my car stalled out. And the only good news about that is that it actually made it here, and the last time that happened to me, I was totally wasted. So I was a lot less worried about it last time. I had absolutely nowhere to be. My sobriety date is June 24th, 2007, and I have a sponsor who's here, and I have a sponsee who's also here, and they are amazing women, and I'm super, super happy that I've gotten to know both of them as well as I have. I wrote down what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, because I have a tendency to go off on tangents, and you guys are here to hear about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and hopefully to identify with what I have to say. That's the whole point of listening to somebody speak. But let me also say that if you don't identify with what I have to say, because I'm just going to tell you the truth and it's really not that interesting, that you should keep coming back and listen to other speakers. Keep going to speaker meetings and listen until you hear something that you can relate to, because that's the hook. That's how I got into this, was by hearing people talk about things that were like somebody read my diary and they were in public speaking about it. And that was the first time that that had ever happened in my life. And so I still get to hear that. And that's why I still go to speaker meetings. It's not to help newcomers. People say that, but I think it's totally bullshit. Anyway, no, if you're new, I care about you. Yeah, but, you know, obviously I care about me more. That's how I got alcoholism in the first place. So, okay, what it was like. I was born here in Tampa. I'm a native Floridian, which is how I knew not to break when I was in 3 feet of water earlier this evening. Don't do that if you're from out of state. That's the worst possible thing you can do. You'll need a new engine. So I was born in Tampa, so I'm sort of a native Tampanian, but we lived in northern Pinellas County, which is, it was like one big orange grove when I was growing up. And I grew up in the 80s, and during that time was when there was a huge influx of people to the state of Florida. That's only kind of stopped in the last couple of years because of our little real estate problem that you might have read about in the paper. So we, but until that time, the population of the state of Florida was like quadrupled in the last 30 years. So it was getting bigger and bigger all the time. Things were happening all the time. And another thing that you might not be aware of if you're not from here is that Florida is the strangest place in the United States, at least, possibly the universe. I'm not sure what's going on, but there's some sort of, spiritual thing. Like people go out to, Sedona to be near God and stuff like that. I mean, this is probably like the on-ramp to hell in many, many ways. And but it's pretty, and there are a lot of nice people. But stay away from like the interstate exit. So my parents are really nice people. They got married a little too young though, and I don't think they ever talked about what they wanted to do with their lives or what their value systems were or anything like that. They met at a party because my mom's date passed out drunk in the bushes and she couldn't find him, and my dad asked her to go to the French Quarter with him, and so she did. And then they both passed out and their car coasted into a tree. And so then they got married shortly after that, because although they were like imbibing quite a bit, we're Irish Catholic, and you couldn't have sex until you got married. So they got married when they were like 20, and that was really stupid. And so they moved down here, and they did the whole middle class regular thing. They got the 3-bedroom, 2-bath, like tract home that's made out of cinder block, and all that kind of crap with the, everything kind of came pre-made. And we lived in this neighborhood that was kind of a starter neighborhood for a lot of young couples at that time and their kids. So there were a lot of kids around, and it was really, really fun where I grew up. All the kids would just play on the street and have a good time. there, you know, because I don't have a ton of time, I'm not going to get into things that are completely tangential. But one thing that I should say about my story is that when I was about 4.5 or 5 years old, my parents got separated, and my brother, who's 15 months younger than me, you know, was there obviously too. So he lived with us, and they got separated, and right around that time, we had a pretty brutal, traumatic event happen in our family. Very close friends of ours were murdered, and my parents were witnesses, and I was kind of a sideways witness. And I was so little that, you know, I couldn't really process it. But and the fact that my father wasn't there anymore was like a big trauma to me at the time, although I didn't recognize it as that at that time at all, because I lived in a really supportive environment. I had a wonderful mom, you know. She read me stories every night before I went to bed and said my prayers, and I ate vegetables every day, and I went to a nice little school, and I used to draw some disturbing pictures. My kindergarten teacher would be like, oh, that's so nice, you know. That's nice, Mara, you know. I don't think they ever got hung up in the classroom. You know, so she was, you know, I had a good life, and the murders were really, really well publicized at the time. Everybody knew about them, because Palm Harbor was a really small town back then. And so, you know, everybody knew about that. Everybody knew my parents were divorced. And that was a good thing, because I didn't have to explain myself to anyone. And I should say that I hear a lot of people say they always felt like an outsider growing up. I knew I was weird, but I thought it was good. And that's a credit to the adults that were in my life at the time, because they knew I was kind of a bizarre little kid. I liked to, you know, draw pictures and paint pictures and bake cookies and, you know, put on plays, and I was really bossy. I would, like, write the play and make everybody, you know, like in the Big Book, be the actors. And the adults in my life just thought that was great and told me how terrific it was. And I really thought that I could be anything that I wanted to be when I grew up. And I was, like, the president of my elementary school in the fifth grade. I ran for president. I made all my posters. I had an edge because my mom was a teacher there, so I got to use all of the, you know, publicly paid-for products to make all of my campaign materials, which is, you know, unethical. So, but I didn't know that. What ended up happening was that my mom got remarried when I was just leaving the fifth grade, and we moved to Lakeland, which is totally, totally different from where I grew up. And I didn't know anybody there, and that was the first time in my life that I was really kind of singled out for crap, you know. And, of course, that was in the beginning of, you know, adolescence and puberty, which was terrific as well. And so that was kind of the beginning of the end for me. I, you know, the other little girls were really not nice. I mean, and in their defense, I was weird, you know. I mean, I have always talked like this, just to give you an idea, you know. I mean, and that was, you know, 12-year-old. I mean, I really have, you know, and I would always, you know, watch soap operas with people's moms and stuff and talk to them about their marriages and stuff. So I was always concerned about stuff, and it was an election year. I was very political. I was the only person who voted for my candidate in my entire school. So, but I was very vocal in my support for Michael Dukakis. Yeah. That was the first of many sinking ships that I've just jumped right on. So anyway, the kids were mean to me, and that's when I really started to I started acting out, and that I learned how to make myself throw up so I wouldn't have to go to school, and I started doing some sort of like self-harming stuff. There weren't a lot of cutters back then, I don't think. I didn't know any cutters, but I would like, you know, I don't even want to get into it. Just, you know, do stuff to make myself sick so I wouldn't have to go to school. And shortly after that, we moved to Sarasota, and I got put in a special school. Oh, let me tell you the other part about this. They didn't open my school records. And if this sounds like I have a resentment, I still do, I think. They didn't open my school records for, like, you know, half of the school year, so they put me in this class. Like, they just determined that I was, like, you know, learning impaired, and they were all color-coded, and of course, the pretty colors were the alleged smart kids, like red and blue, and I was, like, in the orange class, like, orange and brown were the, you know, and you weren't supposed to know, but, I mean, everybody knows, you know? Everybody knows. So, but then they opened up my records and saw all this stuff, and then they put me in the other, but whatever. By that time, it was too late. I was already really, really pissed off. And, we do, I think, still, like, live in a culture where anger is not something that women are allowed to express without, it's not considered feminine. And I was sensitive enough to that at the time that, as angry as I was about all the stuff that was going on, you know, I mean, I'm not with my dad, I'm in this new place, my stepsister moved in, I had to share a room with her, she was 18 years old, all of that kind of stuff that was going on, which really, I mean, cry me a river, a lot of people have it a lot worse than I did, but I was really, really angry, because I didn't know that, I didn't know that many, you don't know that many people when you're 12, so, we didn't have Facebook. And so, I couldn't express that anger, you know, openly, and so it kind of all went inside, and I really started to become very depressed. And I had been a super religious kid. We always had to go to Mass every Sunday, and we said grace every night, and we did all that stuff, and I had been, you know, fully on board with it, and it was around that time that I was really kind of rethinking my position on all that. And so, we moved to Sarasota, and I ended up going to a really great school there, and the 90s came, and in the 90s, and I've said this before, and I apologize if you've heard me speak before, but in the 90s, there was kind of like a musical revolution that happened with everything, and all of a sudden, alternative music became something that you didn't listen to on 88.5 at midnight. It became something that was like everywhere all the time, on MTV, on the news all the time. And so, we really didn't make the news until 1994. But but that was great because really freaky people started to sort of get a foothold in American culture. I really think that before that, it was very homogenous, and you kind of had to stick to a certain kind of thing. I mean, I went from being like 10 years old and thinking anything is possible and I could be anybody that I want to being 12 years old and thinking, if I'm not the captain of the cheerleaders, which is never going to happen because I don't know left from right and I don't have blonde hair, if that, you know, that's never going to happen, my life is totally effing meaningless. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm just going to get kicked around for the rest of my life because there are two things that people really care about in the world, and those things are money and whether you're beautiful. And I knew I didn't have either one of those things. And so, you know, I thought, well, you know, that's it. I don't know what I'm going to do, but it's got to be something kind of off the grid. Well, off the grid became the mainstream, which was really cool. I mean, I ended up being pretty popular in high school, which was strange. I credit my high school boyfriend with a lot of that, and I just spoke with him, and he credits himself as well. he told me, he was like, Mara, coolness is all about proximity, and you had major attention from a major player. I was like, thank you for that. obviously he's a good person, otherwise I wouldn't still be talking to him. So the, high school, blah, 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 I decide, you know, screw this shit, you know, this, you know, I'm going to be a virgin until I get married, I'm never going to drink, I'm never going to do drugs. The just say no to drugs thing happened, and the dare thing happened, and all that kind of stuff. Well, the first time you smoke pot, you learn that that's all bullshit. I didn't jump out of a window. You know, I mean, seriously, I really think that that's why that a lot of people in my generation ended up getting involved in hard drugs, because they just kept saying, like, oh, well, if you do drugs, you know, cast the wide net, you're going to end up, you know, on Skid Row or whatever. And then you start drinking and you start smoking weed and you realize that drinking, you know, if you're me and you're Irish, is way better than marijuana, and it's legal. So obviously this whole thing about marijuana is crap, you know, and they sold us a bill of goods, and that's how you end up getting, you know, involved in other stuff. But so if you take a logical approach to life, which I did, and still totally do. So no. So obviously I'm not a logical person when it comes to my own life decisions. So I started drinking, and the first time I drank, I don't really remember, but I definitely remember the first time I got drunk. It was ridiculous. I mean, I don't know what happened exactly. I know that my best friend and I ended up getting in a bunch of trouble because her mom wasn't supposed to be there. Oh yeah, the other thing was everybody's parents got divorced. My parents were the first parents, but then like everybody's parents got divorced, which means they're totally out to lunch. They're not home. You can do whatever you want to do. And you know, and we lived in Sarasota. Sarasota's like a wealthy community. Like you have to build your house up high because of the water. So like everybody's got all these different floors and stuff like that. Not us, because I mean, let's face it, we were not moving up in the world. But the you know, nobody knew what we were doing, but for some reason she found us on a dock with her enormous grape ape like stuffed animal and my friend's boyfriend, and I don't know what was going on, but we got in trouble. But I was like, this is badass. I'm gonna do this all the time. And you know, I started smoking cigarettes because everybody knows that cigarettes are really cool, and you know, don't buy into the hype. And I'm still addicted to Nicorette gum to this day, even though I quit smoking cigarettes like 10 years ago. So, and cigarettes will make you thin. So I care, you know, thin and beautiful. and so does booze. So, well, and you know, oh, booze, the other thing about drinking is that's awesome, is that you don't eat. So, you know, you can't get fat. I'm not really sure how that works out, but like you just don't metabolize the calories the same way. And so being thin was like in the hierarchy of things that I cared about, like probably number one, you know? And number two was like way down here. So you know, and I always felt awkward around people and all that kind of stuff. I mean, my body senses danger where there is no danger, which is why I like started sweating profusely tonight. You know, I was always that weird, like, sweaty person, you know? I feel that way, you know? I get the shakes. The first time I ever had to do anything in my profession, I was standing up at a podium like this, and my legs were shaking so much that the podium was, like, moving up and down. And so, you know, I definitely have kind of, I don't know, what is it? It's like, it must be glandular or something. But, So I started drinking and obviously I loved it, otherwise I wouldn't be here. And the one thing that a lot of people say, I mean, everybody's got their own deal. Some people started drinking and immediately, you know, they hated the taste and they threw up and it was awful, but they kept doing it anyway and they don't know why. I knew why I did it, and I liked the taste and I liked the way that it made me feel. I liked everything about it. I liked the lie of drinking, the Don Draper Mad Men, you know, martini sophisticated thing. I liked the low bottom crap as much. I loved drinking malt liquor. For some reason, in the state of Florida, one of the things that makes us weird is that 40s are illegal, but you can buy 2 quarts. So, you know. So, you know, just hang outside a gas station, somebody, you know, with your $2 or whatever, and somebody will go in and buy it for you. So, I moved to New Orleans, which, you know, it probably wasn't a good idea for a budding alcoholic. I knew right away that I liked alcohol more than other people liked alcohol. I knew that it did something for me that it didn't do for other people, because it was like an elation. When I drank, it would wake me up. Like some people get kind of sleepy, but for me, the more I drank, the more I wanted to drink, the more I wanted to stay awake and see what was next and let's go to this place and let's go to that place and, you know, let's get in some trouble, you know. let's go swimming was a big one. You know, swimming is not illegal, but swimming at other people's houses when they don't invite you over is burglary. You can trust me on that because I actually know what I'm talking about. So I went to college and I was terrified of getting kicked out of school or flunking out of school because of alcohol. And I could see, you know, on my floor my freshman year, I mean, people were just out of control. You know, people would pass out in the elevators with the elevator doors closing on their heads and stuff like that. And I was terrified of new people, you know, and I hadn't quite put it together that alcohol makes me not terrified of new people. So if I had figured that out, maybe I would have, you know, ended up getting kicked out of school. But I didn't. So what happened was I lent somebody money in the beginning of the year, and they paid me back in a massive amount of marijuana. And so I sat around and smoked weed and watched Quantum Leap and Wings and Cheers every night. And my roommate was a cokehead, and she would go out on these, like, vendors and not come back for a long time. And then when she would come home, if I was watching Cheers when she was coming down, I had to mute it when the theme song for Cheers came on, otherwise she would cry. So that's how I stayed in school. And that's the thing, you know. I mean, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a real alcoholic. I'm not here for really anything else other than just my inherent weirdness. But you know, I mean, I'm an alcoholic. But you know, the drug part of it, I have to say, it has a lot to do with where I came from and what brought me here. Because drugs didn't bring me here. And what ended up happening, I think I've said that about 100 times now, is that I stayed in school. Almost everybody I knew in New Orleans ended up losing their scholarships or leaving, so I had to make all new friends. And that, as you can kind of detect a pattern, was very difficult for me because I was always one of those people who I would make one friend and then I would just cleave onto that person, you know? And it was usually a girlfriend, you know. I wasn't like the boyfriend girl, but I was like the best friend girl. And I would always have some, you know, best friend who was like my wingman and I would go do everything with. I lost 15 pounds my freshman year because I was too nervous to walk across the cafeteria to go get food. I would go get bagels with my little meal card and I would get like three of them and I would bring them back up to my room and I would, you know, put on one of my vintage dresses and, you know, just fire one up and watch some bad TV. And, you know, that was how that went. As time went on, I started to discover the city more, and I started to drink a lot more. And that was when I really felt like, you know, when they say in the book, like, I had arrived. I felt like I had arrived. I felt like being in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club, which is a Quonset hut with a huge Christmas wreath on the outside of it in a very dangerous neighborhood. But when you walk in, like, everybody's like, hey, you know, I felt like I was back in the amniotic fluid. I felt for the first time in my life, I was like, oh, I feel so warm and I feel so good. And they had 50-cent Schlitz, and they had a jukebox that only played vintage R&B, and everybody there was just in a good mood, you know, and there to have a good time. And sadly, after I left New Orleans, Snake and Jake's was the site of an armed robbery, which, I mean, who would come in with a gun and try and rob a bunch of drunks? Like, that just seems to me, like, sacrilegious even still. Like, that's just so, why would you want to pick on somebody that vulnerable? And then also, you know, I mean, they don't have any money, otherwise they wouldn't be at Snake and Jake's for 50-cent Schlitz night, you know? Like, go to the Ritz-Carlton, seriously. So, no, I'm just kidding, because rich people don't carry cash. I know rich people now, so I know that's true. So anyway, I graduated from college, and you know, I was terrified of everything, and I want to get to getting sober. It's 8:24. How much time do I have left? Okay, so I'm gonna try and wrap it up. So my drinking career lasted a long time. I know that there's a lot of people in here who never had a legal drink in their lives. I did, and I wouldn't be up here if things didn't go to hell in a handbasket. It never quite got as good as it was back then, and it started getting worse right away. And so I went to law school, and I couldn't drink during the semester because, and let me explain this to you. If you're an alcoholic like I am, you think to yourself, well, I can't drink tonight. I can't go out with my friends because I have to do something in the morning. You know, that's what I thought. That's what I thought everybody thought. I didn't realize that all of these people were going out every Thursday night and making it to class on Friday morning because they didn't drink 15 drinks, you know. They didn't stay out until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning like I did, and so they could be productive the next morning. They could have 2 or 3 drinks, maybe. Maybe they get tanked at New Year's Eve or something like that, but not every single time that they drank. And that was what happened to me. I had my first blackout when I was about 22, and I didn't have one for a much longer time. But I was terrified. I was terrified of life, and that was a big reason that I went to law school. I wanted to have a job where I could, earn a living, you know, clock in, clock out, and, you know, be respectable in the community and just be left the hell alone, you know. I didn't, you know, I know a lot of people who are involved in, like, the arts and stuff like that, and they are very brave to me that somebody could go out and think, you know, early on in their lives what their passion is and do that for a living. To me, that was not even in my vernacular when I was making decisions about what I was going to do with my life. And so I ended up meeting a guy when I was in law school who, you know, seemed like the perfect guy for me. I mean, he gave me, like, the full court press, which was completely 100% necessary because I wouldn't have figured it out if he hadn't. And so he was a professor, and he was good looking, and he was, you know, very intelligent, and he listened to all the right bands, which was super important to me. Because you have to be cool, you know what I mean? Like, you have to, you know, that's really, really, really important. And so I was engaged to him. Well, I never really loved him. I didn't even think about that, you know? I mean, what? You know, I didn't think about that. I didn't think about that when I was making a decision about what I was going to do with my life for a living. I didn't think about that when I was choosing a life partner. I thought, what is the safest thing that I can do here? You know, what I need to lock something down so that I don't have, you know, a bad situation later on. Because there's all this, you know, the wolves are at the freaking door. So, because it was so rough growing up as a middle-class kid in Florida. You know what I mean? Like, at the mean streets of Palm Harbor. So I was going to marry this guy, and you know, I mean, it was serious. Our record collections were, you know, entwined, you know. That's some serious crap. So I remember somebody saying that to me once when they came over. They're like, really? You guys keep your records together? And I was like, yeah, you know, we're grown-ups. You know, I bought a Volvo. I got a job, and I loved my job. I loved my job, and that was, I think, probably the beginning of the end of that relationship, because I just loved being at work so much. The people I worked with were fantastic, so funny, so smart, and kind. And he was not. I mean, that was not in the top 10 things to look for in a life partner. Being kind, that wasn't something I looked for. You know, 401k. It was. You know what I mean? Or 403b or whatever. You know, I don't know. Depends. Yeah, and I was living this pseudo-adult life, and he told me that we couldn't have TV in our house. I mean, he had all these rules for everything. It was like kind of a trashier version of, like, sleeping with the enemy, which you may have been too young to see, but it was like, you know, because we didn't live in a house that looked like that for sure, but, you know, I wasn't allowed to have cable TV. So I went to Walmart, and I got bunny ears for the TV, and I got one station, which was Fox, and I used to watch everything that was on Fox, like reality TV, like really, really bad TV, and I would just sit in front of the TV and drink Rolling Rock, and he would be like, remember when we used to talk about stuff? And I'd be like, well, I don't have anything to say to you. You know, I mean, what do you want to talk about? Like, he'd be like, you go to bed so early, and I'd be like, well, if something's going to happen, you know, let me know around 6. And you know, whatever. So, but, you know, so he, we moved to Colorado because he got a job out in Colorado, and I was out there studying for the bar and stuff and drinking Rolling Rock, watching Everybody Loves Raymond, and which, you know, I had never seen before I moved to Denver. Not a bad show if you don't have any other channels. So I was sitting there, and that was, I really think, my first spiritual experience was that, you know, his mom came over and he called her a bitch, like, in front of me and my mom. And that was, like, the first time I was like, you know, our private life was like that, but other people didn't see it. And that was the first time that his kind of true nature and character was revealed to my mother, and I was humiliated. And, you know, being around him kept me from really drinking as much as I wanted to, and I really felt like I had wasted my 20s with him. So I left him, you know, the police had to come and all that kind of stuff, and it was really bad, and I lost everything that I owned. He wouldn't let me get any of my stuff out of the house except for the stuff that he was throwing at my head. And so the cops were so nice. The cops in Denver are so nice. we got the hell out of there, and I got back to Gainesville, and I had nothing. I had no bed, no couch, no clothes. I had some of my books some of my clothes. But, you know, my diplomas were gone. My grandmother's wedding dress was gone. Everything was gone. And I got back down there, and that was when I was like, well, it's on, man. Like, this guy was like and just ruining my partying. And so I'm gonna start drinking like I want to, and I did, and I was blacking out all the time. I was sick all the time. You know, I kind of figured out this way to open up my car door and puke at stop signs and stuff like that. I had a little thing that I would do where I would go to McDonald's and get like a massive Diet Coke and a couple plain biscuits. And the whole object of the exercise was to get home so that I could eat them before I threw up, you know. And because I was a puker, some people aren't pukers, you know, but you're going to have some gastrointestinal distress if you end up of some kind, if you drink. Let's just, they should put that shit on the label. Because no, in the words of some of my former clients, nobody told me. So, like, nobody's supposed to have to tell you. I moved down here because, you know, Gainesville was the problem. I got an apartment, which has since been torn down, on Bayshore Boulevard. Those places were really cool. And I really liked Tampa, and I liked my job, and a couple of my friends from school were here, and I was having a great time. But as time went on, the change of scenery wasn't really doing it for me anymore. And it got more and more, just drinking more and more. I was not a morning drinker, but I have to tell you, I think that I was drunk driving to work all the time from the night before. I had this, you know, I had a really good assistant, so I could go home and take a nap, and he would call me if somebody showed up, so I could, like, you know, appear and be like, oh, I was just doing this other thing that was really important. And, you know, and I probably smelled like booze all the time. I remember puking in the bushes outside the courthouse a lot. It was humiliating. I cannot describe how far from the person that I wanted to be I had become. I had no idea how my life became this way. I didn't remember making any of those choices. Like, because the ones that I made were either completely out of fear or made under the influence of alcohol, which is the opposite of making a decision out of fear, and were bad, too, for different reasons. So, I felt alone. I felt, totally afraid. I felt that, I was just a washed-up old maid, and I would look in the mirror, and I would see the lines on my face coming out, and it would just make me so miserable every day. And the amount of self-hatred that I felt was just unbelievable. And I believe that my first spiritual experience was the day that I came into my first AA meeting, because it wasn't any particular thing. I mean, I went to a party that was horrible, and got tanked and had to spend the night and stuff like that the night before, and then went home. But I was just overcome by this massive amount of just grief and self-hatred, and I thought, I'm gonna kill myself if this keeps going on. And I can't stop. But how can I live without it? Because I can't be around people sober. You know, how am I ever gonna go to a party? How am I ever gonna get through a wedding? How am I gonna hang out with my family? I mean, my whole family drinks. If I quit drinking, I just couldn't see any way out. And I called my aunt and my uncle and my best friend, and I totally outed myself to them. So, which indicates to me I was still drunk. And I called general office, and they were like, you know, she asked me when the last time I've been drinking was, and she said, well, you're still drunk. And I was like, screw you, you know, I'm not still drunk. I slept, you know, I've had a shower and a huge Diet Coke. I mean, what doesn't get much more? I could perform surgery right now. But so I just felt like this is it. I'm gonna die. But I wanted to die. You know, if I could have gone to sleep and not woken up, I would have chosen that in that moment rather than come into AA. It was just the affirmative act of committing suicide that I kind of had a problem with at the time. And so I don't know what happened, but I went to my first meeting. And I thought I was in the wrong place because everybody it was at a Protestant church in Palmasia, and everybody looked like was really well dressed. And Sandy was speaking, and he was doing a thing on the 12 and 12 at the time. I don't know what step he was on, and you know, South Tampa AA is kind of hoity-toity anyway. But like, I totally didn't think that the people in there were alcoholics. And but I went in anyway, and I was really, really sweaty, like I am right now, but for different reasons, you know, because my body was trying to push poison out of it. So I went, and somebody gave me a sponsor, a guy, this guy named Guy, was like, here's this girl, and she'll be your sponsor. And so she ended up being my sponsor for the first year that I was sober. And the thing that I have to say about that is get a freaking sponsor if you don't have one. I mean, it does not need to be the perfect person. She was not the perfect person. She was younger than me, which was a big deal to me back then. Still a big deal to me. Like, I'm not going to take orders from you. I could have been your babysitter, for crying out loud. You know? I'll tell you when to go to bed. So, but, you know, she was sober, and I wasn't sober, and she told me what to do, and I did it because I was desperate. And as time went on in the program, I became less desperate, and as I've become less desperate, I've gone to fewer meetings, and I've prayed less frequently, and I've called my sponsor less frequently, and it always ends up having some kind of unforeseen bad side effect. If when I work this program and I do what I'm supposed to do in here, I feel good most of the time. I feel like I can put one foot in front of the other and I can live my life. Life hasn't always been perfect in AA. That is not, I sort of thought that was the promise in the beginning, and that's not the promise, because things happen, you know. People you love are going to die whether you're sober or drunk. You know, you're going to lose a job, or you're going to have financial setbacks, whether you're sober or drunk. The difference is that being sober means that I can potentially do something about it. It means that when I get a flat tire, I'm not thinking, well, I'm going to throw myself in front of the 18-wheeler that comes along because I don't have any money in my bank account to fix my flat tire. Everybody thinks I'm a loser and blah, 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 blah. You know, I mean, if I think that now, which occasionally I do, I have somebody to call. So, you know, the benefits of this program are really like too many to even list. There's just not enough time. But if you haven't heard what you need to hear from me tonight, or you haven't heard what you need to hear from somebody, stick around and listen, because I guarantee that there is somebody out there who cares whether you live or die. And if you hang around here long enough, you're going to see that there are people who don't get this, unfortunately. And I didn't care whether I lived or died when I walked into the rooms of AA, but people did care if I did. And I'm thankful every day that I can be there for my family and for the people that I love, physically and emotionally, and that I'm not a drain on their resources or another bad memory that they have to go to therapy to think about anymore. So that's all I have to share, and thank you so much for asking me to speak.